Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, cancel the millennium because this movie sucks. This is Wild Wild West. Welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly. I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Wild Wild West, yes. Which we'll be talking about today.
Wild movie.
Which, in stark contrast to our intro tagline, is a bad movie that did badly. So it covers both those bases.
We got it covered this week.
So before we get into that, Ian, how are you doing?
I'm like the Michelin man in that I am rather tired.
Oh boy.
Am I like gourmet food? I don't know. I had to say something. Yeah. I've been real tired this week, but I feel like I'm coming out of a funk, getting more energy. Weather's cool. I've got some warm tea in my sippy cup. And so, yeah, I'm jazzed to talk to you tonight.
You said the weather's cool. It was 68 degrees in New England today, which is not seasonal. It is supposed to be in the low 30s, maybe snowing. Some years we already have snow on the ground this time of year.
Oh, okay.
And it is damn near 70 degrees today. So I don't know what the fuck's going on.
Well, see, that's the weather we had. And I was calling that cool because that's LA cool.
Right. That's cool for you. And that's pretty cool. That's cool for you. I'm a little jealous, but I'm not complaining, but then there's snow in the forecast for next week. So who knows what the fuck's going on? It's very confusing. And I feel like I've had a cold for 4 months now, mostly because the weather's so inconsistent.
Ugh.
Wreaks havoc on your immune system. But you've all heard me complain about my colds plenty of times. Let's not relitigate my immune system. Let's talk movies. Before we get into this week's movie, though, you know what we always have to do. Got to talk about something we watched that we thought was interesting or cool that maybe would be fun for our listeners to hear about. So, Ian, what do you got for me? What did you watch?
You know how I love to bring thematic items to the show and tell.
You do.
And so I went to the Old West and I dug up Deadwood.
Oh.
Which is an all-time favorite of mine, but I realized I haven't watched it in 15 years. That show ran from 04 to 06, which is a long time ago. And I hadn't turned it on probably since the end of season 3. And man, it's so good. It is crackling good. I don't use that expression ever, except it came into my mind when I was watching this show. There's all this stuff that seems to be the topic of the show, sex, murder, crooked dealing. And in reality, that's the sideshow. It's a character show. It's such strong character drama. Man, they throw you in this world with these characters. And so fast, you know who everybody is and what's peculiar about each one of them. And then you get so worked up because you see these two characters and you're like, oh my God, this guy is so much this way. And this guy is such a that guy. And they're about to have to meet and deal with each other. And just the anticipation of the fireworks. It's just crazy how many characters they set up so fast that you get excited to see interact. It's a terrific show.
Yes, I'm also a big Deadwood fan. A lot of my favorite performers were on that show. Just great writing. Now, you said you hadn't watched it since the end of season 3, but I assume you watched the movie when it came out, right?
I did not.
What?
I was into like a cool zone of Deadwood, and I wasn't like ready to appreciate it. So I'm like, I'm going to have to just park that and come back to it. So now I think I'm building up to it here.
The movie is very good, very well regarded.
Okay.
I was actually just reading an article that the AV Club did, which was about TV shows that chose to wrap up years later with movies. And they talked about El Camino, which was the Breaking Bad movie about Jesse Pinkman. And they talked about the Deadwood movie. And they talked about The Many Saints of Newark, which was an attempt at that closure and failed in that regard.
Kind of a dud by most accounts.
Yeah, I was not a fan. I think I called it Sopranos Muppet Babies. But the Deadwood movie is held in high regard. And I'm excited for you to check it out because I think you're going to dig it.
That's fun. I have a little treat that I've been saving.
So I have a treat, but it's not one that I've been saving. It's brand new. This brand new show I checked out. As of this recording, there's only one episode out there. It's called Yellow Jackets. It's on Showtime. It is about a girls' high school soccer team that is going for some national tournament and ends up crash landing in the Ontario wilderness. And based on the small glimpses that we get of them living in that wilderness for 19 months, I think it was, things go very wrong. And then we'd catch up with some of the characters as adults and see how they're living with the secrets that they bear every day. And it seems like it's going to be a real dark, fucked up kind of mishmash between Lost and Lord of the Flies, maybe, but darker than Lost by any measure because it's on a premium network and can show a lot more of the brutality involved. Yeah, I love the cast. Christina Ricci, one of our favorites.
Sure.
Big role in there. Juliette Lewis. It's a very interesting cast. And I'm on board for this now. Did you have a chance to check this out? I know I texted you about it to recommend it.
I only got to see the first 10 minutes of the episode, so I have a little sense of the flavor, and there's quite a juxtaposition between the contemporary lives of these women and the little snapshots of that time in the forest, which seems just utterly brutal. And so I'm excited to go back for more.
Yeah, it seems like a fun new show. There's a lot of buzz around it. It's getting great reviews across the board. So hopefully it's a hit and we get the full story that they're hoping to tell. I don't know if this is a multi-season thing or it's going to be a one and done, but either way, yeah. I'm excited to see.
It's interesting how much premium cable has ridden this current wave of dark, gritty, conceptual things. And we started to think that some of that was burning out and that people were getting tired of that and that the new style would be Ted Lasso. But I'm still down for it when you get a cool idea like this and it seems to be executed well. I'm still excited for it.
That's the key. As long as it's executed well, I'm on board. You know, I love my Ted Lasso shows and my escapist, wholesome pop culture. But at the same time, there's nothing better than just really dark, gritty, well-told story. So if they deliver on the promise of the first episode, I'm excited.
And if there's a dark, gritty general with a disfigured ear, I mean, even better.
No,
like that would really put it over the top.
That would ruin it. Wild, Wild West. Yeah. I guess I was waxing poetic about Yellow Jackets because I really don't want to talk about this fucking movie. Actually, I'm excited to record this episode so I could put this movie behind me and never think about it again. But no, this movie, what did you know about it? Did you see it when it first came out or did you just watch it for the first time for the podcast?
I had a strange experience. I'll tell you, coming to this for the pod, I thought that I had seen this movie and it was in this box in my mind of, okay, funny popcorn action movie and just agreeable in some form. And then I found out just fucking A, my memory cannot be trusted. Either I got a false memory implanted through some means of suggestion. I may have liked the music video and thought I had seen the movie and put it in the okay box because of Will Smith's music video. Or I was just a horrible person in 1999 and I don't recognize that guy that I was that loved Wild Wild West. So
I fucking hope it's not that
way. Or I could just be losing my mind, which is actually pretty high likelihood. So it was really weird because I thought I was going in to see a movie that would be agreeable and you started dropping hints to me like, this thing is kind of a stinker. And then I put it on. I'm like, holy shit.
I think I
shit.
Used stronger language than that. But yeah, you're in the ballpark of what I had to say about it when I was like 20 minutes in. No, I was shocked by how bad this movie was. It's been a while since we've had a movie that we can just unanimously dunk on for an hour and 10 minutes. But I remember when this movie came out, I was like 11 or 12 years old and it had a bad enough reputation, even among people of my age group that I was like, I don't need to see that.
Wow.
And coming from me, who was like a big Will Smith fan at the time, I'd enjoyed The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I'd liked pretty much every movie he'd made up until that point that I'd seen, because we'll go over it. His career was a rocket straight to the moon at this point. He was the biggest movie star in the world, probably. This movie really stopped his momentum, surprisingly so. When I was looking at what he did after this, I thought his run of successful movies lasted until the late aughts. But no, this movie put him on a downward path that I was shocked to see. It's that bad. And it really is that bad. It's shockingly bad. I don't have much else to say about it generally, but we'll get into the specifics of why it's so bad, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it sounds like we're winging it at all during this episode, it's probably because we could not bother to pay too much attention to this movie. We both like to do a couple watches if we can, and neither one of us wanted to go back for that second watch.
No, I actually put my foot down and I told you that I'm watching this movie one time and I will not watch it a second time. I don't care if I miss some small details like in the summary or the synopsis. Opposite of the movie, I am okay with that sacrifice for my own sanity.
I went back because it took us a while to get into the studio to tape this. I'm like, I better just watch a little bit of it because I feel like the whole thing is fading from my mind. And in my little partial rewatch, I realized how much of it I had tuned out. Like, I was surprised by how much detail there is in the movie. I'm like, wow, this movie is not just broad brushstrokes and cheap facades. I'm like, look at all these sets and all these people, and they're saying things. There's a lot of details to the plot about the machinery, and we're meeting here, and there's a guy, and there's a map, and you see exactly how they got the map and knew when to go where. I'm like, I missed all those details in the first go-around because I was so put off by the tone, by the look. There's like a lot of things that make you go, ugh, and step back from the screen in this movie, and then you miss it. But then when you go back and get into all those details, it didn't make it better. It made it more detailed, but just as bad.
Yeah, certainly a painstakingly made movie. We'll get into the budget of this movie and how massive it was. I mean, a lot of stuff was built for this, a lot of big sets, a lot of big set pieces were done with practical effects for this movie. It's a fucking expensive movie. This budget by today's standards is massive. And all that detail and all that work and all that money just for this, it almost makes you angry, angrier. Like, I can cut a $15 million movie some slack for not being the best put together thing you've ever seen on the screen. But when you take hundreds of millions of dollars and this is what you come up with talented people involved,
Yeah, all throughout it. I really felt there is a cognitive dissonance when you watch it, especially on the screen. We trust Will Smith and to a lesser extent, Kevin Kline and the other stars of this movie to be funny and also to be smart and self-aware, like smart people as actors and personalities. And it's just stunning how wrong the writers got every scene and every joke. And it's hard to figure out what were these guys thinking? They were shooting all these scenes. This took a lot of time. They went in scene after scene and pressed forward and made a whole movie. And you just wonder what they were thinking. But I mean, they tried. Yeah, I guess you could give them some points for trying. You see them in every scene.
No, I give them no points for trying. You talk about a lot of people worked on this movie and sacrificed for this. Not only people, but locations. They burned down the Cook Movie Ranch, a famous shooting location for Old West type stuff, was burned down because of this movie. It's outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. There was a pyrotechnic stunt done and a planned building fire went out of control and burned down this very prestigious and historic Old West set that they had been using for this movie. So yeah, real consequences.
It's kind of symbolic of the movie, I guess. They should have seen that as an omen, as a portent of things to come.
Do you want me to tell you how this pile of dog shit got made and came together?
Sure, let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. Bad Boys, Independence Day, Men in Black, Enemy of the State. These are the movies Will Smith starred in from 1995 to 1998, a nearly unprecedented run of both critical and commercial success. It would not be an exaggeration to call him the biggest movie star in the world when 1999 rolled around. Smith's next big budget adventure would be a film adaptation of Michael Garrison's television show, The Wild Wild West, which aired on CBS from 1965 to 1969. The film had been in some stage of development since 1992, with Richard Donner originally slated to direct a movie from a Shane Black screenplay that would star Mel Gibson as Jim West.
They called it Lethal Lethal West.
Donner and Gibson would leave the project to adapt another old-timey Old West TV show in Maverick, and Tom Cruise would then begin talks to star as West before also leaving to adapt an old-timey TV show and make the first Mission Impossible movie.
They called it Knock Knock List.
Smith and Sonnenfeld began negotiations to take over the project in February 1997 after working together on Men in Black when veteran screenwriting duo S.S. Wilson and Brent Maddock would be hired to write the screenplay. George Clooney would sign on to play Artemis Gordon in August 1997, but dropped out after a reportedly heated argument with Sonnenfeld and would be replaced by Kevin Kline. The pre-production troubles continued as duo Jeffrey Price and Peter S. Seaman, best known for writing Who Framed Roger Rabbit, were hired to rewrite the original screenplay.
They called it Toontown.
Filming would finally begin in April 1998, with set work being shot on the Warner Brothers lot in LA and exteriors and location shooting shot near Santa Fe, New Mexico. Test screenings did not go well, as audiences reportedly couldn't tell if the film was supposed to be a comedy, and reshoots were ordered to inject more humor into the film. Many members of the cast and crew had already soured on the movie, with Smith confirming he knew the movie wasn't any good, and Warner Brothers' own quality control department expressing their reluctance to work on it. The final budget was reported to be in the range of $170 million, nearly $300 million in 2021 money.
But only $14 million in 1869 money.
And the film would need to be a massive hit to avoid a loss for the studio. Reviews were overwhelmingly negative, with the movie currently sitting at 17% on Rotten Tomatoes. Unfortunately for Warner Brothers, audiences agreed with the critics, the cast, and the crew, and the movie would eventually earn only $220 million worldwide. On the bright side, the Will Smith rap song of the same name was a hit, I guess.
Wild Wild West. I'm not going to try to sing it.
Wild West. Jim West. Desperado. That's all. I remember the opening lines to that song. I did not listen to it for this podcast, but the song was fine.
The song was fine.
I don't hate the song.
For the sake of the podcast, I went on YouTube and I found him doing the live version of it at some music awards show. And man, they put a lot of effort into it. I didn't remember that Will Smith did choreography back in those days, live on stage. And the dance moves were kind of goofy.
You don't remember the getting jiggy with it dance? It was like one of these things.
Well, I could picture that.
I'm doing the getting jiggy with it. Right.
Yeah, now. I see that. You are getting jiggy. And I'm with it, but it was very much like pop choreography. And then there's a lot of guests on that track too.
Cisco, I know.
Cisco sings the Stevie Wonder part from the song they lifted it from. And Kool Moe Dee.
Because Cisco is a viable replacement for Stevie Wonder. I'm sure Stevie Wonder would agree.
Yeah, I mean, just as good.
It's a one-to-one deal. Transfer.
The heir apparent. And then Drew Hill. Is Drew Hill a person or a group? Is that two people?
No, Drew Hill is Cisco's group.
Okay, so they're mentioned as also featuring on this.
You said Kool Moe Dee?
And Kool Moe Dee, yeah. Yeah, they were reaching back for some old school street cred.
Wow. Now you're going to tell me DMX was on the track too, or Jadakiss, the grimiest rappers you can imagine.
It was weird. That's fun to watch. I actually recommend watching that for just a weird 1999 time capsule and to see Will Smith doing his thing.
Well, he's a great performer, which is why this movie is so perplexing to me, because there's nothing about it that's good, not his performance. Like, you could usually count on him to at least be fun in a bad movie, but no.
Yeah, you feel bad because, at least I did, you may have lost all sympathy for this movie, but I felt bad. I saw him working, trying to turn on his charm. He's got his signature moves. He tries them all out in this. He's doing all his moves that you know he can pull off and make really funny because you've seen him do it over and over. And the jokes are so bad and the premises are so offensive going in that he just can't even, he has no chance of ever saving any of them.
Yeah, you crystallized my main issue with this movie is, and we ask this question a lot on this podcast, which is, who is this movie for? But I've never felt it so thoroughly as I do with this movie, because it's a very like childish concept and a lot of the set design seems to be aimed at kids. But there's a lot of jokes about racism and slavery, and like gay panic is 80% of the jokes in this movie and the rest are about racism.
Yeah.
So who is this movie for? Kids aren't going to appreciate that humor or even get it half the time, because a lot of it's tied to post-Civil War America and specific things that went on back then.
Yeah, they pulled up a lot of really dark themes and then they tried to joke about them, but in just the worst way. Like, we named the writers and they were real Hollywood writers with real credentials, but it felt to me watching through it, I'm like, did they just let junior execs pitch everything they wanted and then they just did it? Or my other theory was they let an office full of stockbrokers write this movie. Guys like, oh, we love to joke around in the office. We're always razzing on each other, you know, and we make fun of people, but they could take it because they dish it out. Like, right. People who like...
It's a joke, man. Yeah. A lot of that energy going on here.
Yeah, it's a bad energy, man. And Will Smith and Kevin Kline can't lift it.
Bad energy is a good way to describe it, because this movie is like, and I don't mean from a photography standpoint or a design standpoint, just like it's ugly at its core. It's a very mean, nasty movie.
Yeah, the attitude of the jokes is ugly. But I would also add that the faces of the people are ugly, especially in the opening couple of sequences. It actually turned me off. The people that you meet right out of the gate are like, ooh, why do I got to look at this?
Yeah, I mean, specifically Ted Levine, who maybe is not a beauty queen by anybody's standards, but he's not the worst looking person of all time. This movie makes him just repellently gross.
Yeah, and you spend a lot of time looking at his face in the first 10 minutes.
He's almost set up like he's going to be the heavy of the movie. We come to find out he's more of a lackey, but he's heavily featured and he's got, what would you call it?
Some kind of ear
hearing
horn.
Aid apparatus, but it's an old timey horn, because this movie also has a very steampunk aesthetic that it's trying to hit. So yeah, fuck this movie though. But yeah, Ted Levine, pretty much terribly served by this movie. I'm shocked he was able to get roles after this. And he's a great actor.
Both of the bad guys, starting with Ted Levine and then escalating to Kenneth Branagh, we'll get into the details of them as we get into the plot. But the tone for this movie, as you said, is all over the place. And these guys are also unable to strike any kind of tone that makes sense and is palatable. And so they end up both being too evil and just sort of grotesquely unlikable. And it just makes it hard to like the movie, because the movie is tongue-in-cheek in a lot of ways, but yet the villains are so off-putting that it makes it not fun.
They feel transported from like a rated R movie or something. Yeah. But also, what the fuck is the name Arliss Loveless? What kind of rural juror bullshit is this? You fucking kidding me?
I was going to say rural juror. Arliss Loveless. This is
Arliss Loveless. Can't fucking say it.
Same naming book.
Or what was the sequel to Rural Juror? Urban Fervor. That's right. That was the Kevin Grisham. All right, Ian, why don't you tell us what the fuck happens in this pile of dog shit.
All right. So the year is 1869. Army Captain Jim West, played by Will Smith, and U.S. Marshal Artemus Gordon, played by Kevin Kline, meet while they're both pursuing former Confederate Army General Bloodbath McGrath. The two don't get along because West likes to solve problems with his guns, while Gordon prefers using clever disguises and inventing fantastical gadgets. After General McGrath gets away, West and Gordon meet again at the White House, where President Ulysses S. Grant tells them they must work together to solve a case and reveals that McGrath is part of a conspiracy to develop a superweapon and force the surrender of the United States government. Grant gives them a fancy train called the Wanderer to get around in on their new mission.
Yeah, fuck you. I have to say, covering this movie gives me a lot of respect for the podcasts that only cover bad movies.
Uh-huh.
Because this is exhausting, right?
You would be in a bad mood all the time if that's all you got
right?
to do.
Yeah, this early section of the movie is, it's bad. It's we open, if I'm not mistaken, with Jim West making out with a lady?
Yeah. Well, there's a cold open before the cold open of the head chopping off. But we don't have to talk about that because that's just...
And the long, like, Gunsmoke-ish intro.
Right.
With not even the original Wild Wild West theme. They didn't want to do that. They wrote a brand new song for it.
Yeah. But music is not bad. The composer is Elmer Bernstein, I think. I'll just bleep that out if I got it wrong.
What do you know? He wasn't wrong.
But a very accomplished composer. It has that nice Western feel. Like, there's a lot of the trappings of fun throwback to 60s TV Westerns. Like, it could have been fun, but no.
I did want to note that in this scene where West is making out with his lady friend, they're both moaning, like, a lot. There's just moaning happening while they're kissing, and they're not doing anything else. It just seems like too much moaning for just kissing. It was off-putting, to say the least.
And this is where we right away bump up against the PG-13. They're in this, it's not a hot tub, it's a water tower. He's somehow hiding out in it, and he's turned it into a sex spa with Garcelle Beauvais, who looks very beautiful in this. She's clearly nude, because you can almost see her through the clear water. They're making out, making a lot of noise, and then he gets dumped out, and there's a couple shots that give you glimpses of Will Smith's package or a stuntman's junk. Just real quick flashes there, and again, you're like, who's this movie for, and what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, and the thugs that he ends up in a shootout with remark upon his package a few times. I think there's a few jokes regarding
one of them
it.
Is distracted, looking down at it, and gives him a chance to punch him in the face.
Yeah, so that's how we start, just to give you an idea of what kind of foot we get off on in this movie.
It's this long opening sequence that introduces you to, obviously it's got to get you both main characters and get you into the action. And it's just, it's loud and it's noisy and just a lot of shit is going off in your face. It's like, it's off-putting in its tone and pace and density to me. I was like, oh man, I just got to get through the scene. Like, they get to this saloon where a big showdown's going to happen. And I was just like, oh man, get it over with. Just fight, do whatever you have to do to get out of this place, because I don't like being here.
You're watching the clock already. And yeah, we're 15 minutes into the movie. But we also have to talk about Kevin Kline, because when we meet him, he is, of course, dressed as a woman because the movie thinks that is the height of comedy. It's a well it comes back to frequently.
Oh, over and over.
There's a few things this movie thinks are hilarious. Let me list them for you. Racism and slavery. Men dressed as women and gay panic. That's pretty much every joke in this movie can be, and like body horror to a lesser degree.
Yeah. And mocking disability.
Yes. That's another one. Okay. So five jokes in this movie that just are repeated over and over again. And I would say none of them are worth half a fuck.
No, like, obviously you have to make a nod to it. You're casting a black actor in the immediate post-Civil War South, and you can't pretend that's not there. You have to confront it. But man, I don't know, you have to do it more skillfully than these guys did. They just made a mess of it.
Well, a script written by five white guys, a comedy script written by five white guys is not equipped to deal with post-Civil War racial politics, no matter how good their intentions may have been. And I'm not even willing to give them that much. But anyway, let's get on with the fucking story. So we meet Ulysses S. Grant, but also we don't, because it's Kevin Kline again. But then the real Ulysses S. Grant walks in, also played by Kevin Kline. Well, that's not confusing at all.
I mean, they do this whole first scene to establish that Kevin Kline thinks he's a master of disguise, and yet it's very transparent that his disguises aren't as good as he thinks they are. And then they do another scene where they're like, cast him as the guy he's playing to prove that he actually is a master of disguise. His Ulysses S. Grant getup is fucking perfect. We
Except
already
the ring
don't...
is the tell.
Oh yeah, he's wearing this Harvard ring, which almost gets his head blown off, which was also just off-putting. Your hero, Will Smith, putting a gun to the face of the president or whoever is in disguise as the president, and just in a really threatening, not in a comedy way. That was an uncomfortable moment. And that was supposed to teach us the difference between these characters. One of them loves disguises and the other one solves every problem with a gun to the face. But I don't know. It didn't endear me to Jim West at all. It made me think he was a fucking maniac.
And then he goes on to call Gordon half a sissy because he was dressed as a woman, which is another.
Yeah.
Like, you're not making your character likable here. He's violent and a bigot so far. So. Yeah.
And he doesn't really get better.
No.
When he meets our disabled villain. Yeah.
Arliss Loveless, a.k.a. the rural juror himself. Let's see what he gets up to. You want me to tell you what goes on?
I guess so. Something else happened. Let us have it.
All right. So, oh, I did want to say, the train, pretty cool. The Wanderer is a cool train. I would like to ride on that train. I mean, take away all the gadgets and stuff, but just like a train with a pool table, that's pretty cool.
Yes, there are cool things about the train. And one of them is Emmett Walsh, who is the conductor who makes every movie better that he shows up in. The gadgets are so dumb. Why?
The gadgets themselves are bad, yeah.
Why is there a spring on one particular corner of the rear platform that lands you in a chair next to Gordon? It clearly doesn't make any sense except to have Will Smith sit in a chair next to Gordon in a dramatic way. And this is where the movie starts to get Looney Tunes for me. And I'll bring that up later as we hit a bunch of things. The movie veers into Looney Tunes cartoon territory and its logic of the physical world in a bunch of places. And it's not good.
Well, let's get into that then. So West and Gordon track McGrath to a masquerade ball hosted by evil mastermind Dr. Arliss Loveless, played by Kenneth Branagh, who rides a steam-powered wheelchair. Loveless mocks West for his race, and in return, West mocks Loveless for his disability, so everybody's doing great. Tensions escalate as the crowd of Confederate Party guests try to lynch West, but he talks his way out of it. Gordon helps West escape, along with burlesque entertainer Rita Escobar, played by Salma Hayek, who Loveless had imprisoned as a sexual slave. This is a children's movie. Meanwhile, Loveless has taken his foreign dignitary guests to a nearby location, where he demonstrates the power of his new weapons by gunning down General McGrath's entire unit of ex-Confederate soldiers. And he personally kills McGrath to boot. Loveless leaves on his armored train, and the good guys give chase on their train, and they have a train fight, but Rita fucks up and gets them all captured. Loveless drops off West and Gordon at a detention camp in the desert, and heads off to complete his evil plan to capture President Grant at the Golden Spike Ceremony in Utah.
Oh man, this is where you're like, oh, I made it through the first act. I saw that weird saloon scene with all the burlesque, and then it gets worse. You're back at another party, masquerade ball, and you have to meet Loveless. And he is a handful, man. What do you make of Kenneth Branagh?
Oh, he's terrible. The character is too much, and the performance is horrendous. Why do you cast an Irishman to play this Kentucky Fried caricature of a Southerner and do what Kenneth Branagh himself calls the worst American accent ever put to film?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I actually didn't have that much problem with the accent because everything else was distracting me. Like, this character is just vile. And I have to give Branagh credit for it because he really plays him vile, even though he's partially intended to be comic relief because he's so over the top and the accent is part of that, the whole Foghorn Leghorn style of talking. But I actually wasn't bothered by the accent, but I was really bothered by the character. He's too offensive. But you know, on my second watch, I'm like, wait a minute, was Daniel Day-Lewis watching this? Because he took some notes. He's like, I see what Ken did wrong here. And then he busted out Bill the Butcher 3 years later and he got...
How dare you, sir?
He got Best Actor noms for it. And Branagh's like, what the fuck?
How fucking dare you? Bill the Butcher is one of the greatest performances ever put to screen.
But you got to admit, they have a lot of things in common. Weird facial hair, over-the-top deliveries and accents and clothes. And
I'm glaring into the webcam right now so you can see my fury. Sure, I guess there are some superficial similarities between the two. But I do not think Daniel Day-Lewis took any notes. Do you think he saw this movie?
I don't know. He's a weird guy.
You think Daniel Day-Lewis watched Wild Wild West? He is a weird guy. I wonder if he's
he watch any movies? He might not. He might not like movies.
If he's playing a character that likes to watch movies, I bet he watches movies in character.
That's right.
So if he was playing an idiot who likes Wild Wild West, maybe he's seen it. But I can't think of any characters he played that would have enjoyed this movie.
We'll keep his name out of our mouths for the rest of this episode. Episodes, as we call them here in the zone.
So that's Loveless. He is repellent. He's not a villain you enjoy watching. I think he goes too far and just becomes a villain that you really don't like to such a degree that he's not even fun to hate.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He doesn't have any of those characteristics. Like, if you want to talk about Bill the Butcher, he is a villain, but he's compelling and you understand his motivation and you enjoy watching him, even if you're rooting against him. With Loveless, you just don't want him on your screen, at least in my experience.
Yeah, totally. I did not want him on my screen. And it's weird though. It's every little thing about it, but I got to give a lot of credit to Branagh. Like, yes, he had a disgusting facial hair. Yes, the steampunk wheelchair thing was off-putting the way he was really severed quite high up on his waist. It's hard to imagine anyone could have survived what he survived in that period of medical history. I guess True. That's part of it, that he's supposed to be improbably wounded in the war. But he does a lot of improbable things, including building giant spiders. Which
the backstory of the giant spider is probably my favorite bit of trivia around this movie. Some of you probably have heard the story, but it's fun. We'll get into it when the time comes. But yeah, there's other ghoulish things about this movie. The severed head projector you called out is just a weird touch that the movie, like, if you had it and you move on, fine. It's a weird little flourish, and it's a bit of inventive technology for this period of time, but then Smith just keeps drawing attention to it.
It's tough for all kinds of reasons. We should explain it. To figure out where McGrath was headed, Artemus Gordon requests the severed head of the man who was last killed by this flying buzzsaw machine. And then he rigs it up upside down in front of a projector, and he tells you about his theory how the retinas save the last image of a dying man. Anyway, he's got this dead man's head, and he's shining a light out of the eyes, and that's how they figure
out. Which is bullshit, by the way, right?
Which it's totally fantasy. It's in the fantasy.
It's complete made-up nonsense.
But you're like, okay, well, what is this character that Gordon can act with that kind of, what is it supposed to tell us about him that he acts that way about a man's head? Not just that he does it, but that it's called out because Jim West won't shut up. There's a whole long scene and he just keeps saying, that's a man's head. And he keeps saying it slower and more drawn out. And I just want him to stop saying that. But I got it because what the fuck's going on in the scene? I did not get the point besides just being a clever thing. But it's so disturbing what it tells you about the character.
I don't think, the filmmakers examined it on that level to be like, oh, are we actually alienating the audience from our hero in this scene? And they were just like, cool little set piece. And it also struck me, or at least West's reaction to it, once I learned about the reshoots to make the movie more of a comedy, like his repeating that this is a man's head felt like something they put back into the movie to drive home the fun. Like, hey, this is a joke. This is supposed to be funny and not upsetting and not make you hate the hero of the movie.
Yeah, it didn't work. But then again, nothing did.
Yeah, let's talk about this this ball that they meet Loveless at, because they also meet Bai Ling playing a character. What is her name? Miss East.
Miss East. Something East. I didn't catch her full name.
And what's Will Smith's character's name?
Something West.
Do you see where I'm going here?
Yeah. In case I didn't, they made sure that we all did.
They say East meets West at least four times, I think.
Yeah. She does it right away. And then they say it again in case you were chewing your popcorn loudly a second ago.
Yeah. Very cool.
And they make her say it so that it's not like him doing a tasteless joke, but it's just as tasteless out of her mouth.
Also, Bai Ling didn't write the fucking script. So it's like, right. No, you can see the wheels turning. Someone else is behind this. Yeah, just the absolute laziest bullshit that passes for humor in this movie. Like we said, racism, one of the core tenets of their humor.
Yeah, they couldn't get away without it. And then the bullshit that also passes for drama, because then she comes back to him later when he's spying and stealing info from the boss's office. And she starts making out with him, like, okay, she's doing it to distract him because she's already on to the fact that he's working against her and her boss, Loveless. But still, that itself turned me off. It's like a cheap knockoff of a James Bond movie where your hero instantly beds all the good-looking women. But it cut to that so quickly without any, I don't know, it's like everything else. It didn't work. And it just turned you off.
And because we find out through Rita that Loveless keeps women as sex slaves, we also know Miss East's predicament is probably not the best. So at that point in time, you're like, she's clearly not doing this of her own free will, which gives another like gross layer.
It's just, if you even think about that, which I guess I couldn't. I was distracted by the close-up of her entire ass.
Yeah, what the fuck is this movie doing? The nudity in this movie? I went into this movie being like Wild Wild West, a movie I didn't see at 11 years old because I thought it was for kids or whatever. And I was too cool and grown up to see it.
No, it was too grown up for you.
Clearly. This movie is all over the place as far as the tone it's trying to strike.
And that was like a totally gratuitous close-up. It was, oh, I'm going to sit down on the desk, bring the camera in close to my butt.
It was playing to the cheap seats, let's say.
The other thing in the scene ends with, as she's distracting Jim West with some French kissing, there are assassins hiding in the paintings on the wall. This room is covered with these large canvases hung all over the walls. And some of them are not paintings. Some of them are people that kind of look like paintings standing there and they've got guns and they shoot at Jim West, but he kills them with his gun.
Did you consider that these are paintings like from the Harry Potter universe and maybe that these are just people trapped in them?
That would have been interesting. I don't think that was it. I think this was another one of my Looney Tunes logic moments of the movie is you can't be 10 feet away from a fake painting, a life-size man standing in front of you and think it's a flat painting. In my world.
No, the three-dimensional, like if it was like a suit of armor or something, maybe right. I could see it because it's at least a three-dimensional and you can understand because you see all those street performers that pretend to be statues or whatever and then come alive at the last minute.
Yeah, if it was a statue.
That would have worked.
If it was a Times Square statue guy, that would have worked for me logically. Or if the room had not been really brightly lit, if the paintings had been far away and the far wall, but they're like all around him. It's perfectly bright in this place. And yet there's three or four of them. Yeah. And obviously they did not fool him. He knew exactly where they were because he whips out his gun and shoots all of them in 1 second.
Is it possible we are trying to apply too much logic to a movie where somebody uses a severed head as a means to project a man's last dying images.
Yeah, we clearly are. But it's hard to throw that away.
So this scene wraps up, and then we move on to the next terrible scene, which is the slur fight.
Yeah.
Between Loveless and West.
Slur fights are fun. You know how those Hollywood studio execs are always calling down to the director, hey, you need to punch up this movie. Put in a slur fight.
Audiences love them. So yeah, West makes several jokes at Loveless's expense because he is in a wheelchair. And Loveless makes several jokes at West's expense because he's black.
Yeah.
And this is his comedy.
Yeah, they're trying to set each other off or show without saying it that they hate each other. It's tasteless. It's uncomfortable. It's not funny.
At least the tastelessness doesn't continue when Jim West plays the bongos on a woman's breasts because he thinks it's Gordon and then he is almost lynched. Yeah.
You just should not, under any circumstances, make a near lynching funny unless you acknowledge the pain, but there's no acknowledgement.
Right. It keeps going back to what I would describe as it's a movie that is not nearly equipped to deal with the topics it's trying to joke about. It does not have the bandwidth or the intelligence to deliver on these jokes in a way that is anything but highly offensive and upsetting. So, and then we got to talk about Rita because Selma Hayek, big actress cast in this movie, featured prominently in the marketing.
Sure.
Kind of a non-entity, right?
Kind of, again, just a poorly written character where she does a bunch of different things at different points in the movie, but doesn't have a coherent role. She starts out as kind of a nobody, which is part of the story. She's pretending to be a nobody because she's actually the wife of one of the key scientists who we don't care about because we've never seen and we don't meet him till everything is over. But she's going to turn out to be the plucky hero. But then she's also a bumbling fool, like for no good reason. She knocks them out with their own sleeping gas when they were trying to avoid getting captured.
And the movie abandons her for long stretches, I feel like, too, once it introduces her. She's just off screen for a long time, which is, if she's supposed to be the third lead, you're really doing her a disservice. And Selma Hayek, great actress, great comedic actress too.
Yeah.
But just not used nearly as well as she could have been here.
Yeah. And this takes us back. She's the one who's in the most obvious jeopardy and one of the least funny aspects that they play off of. If you think about it all, they move past it pretty quickly. But when we meet her, she's singing in the saloon. And then later, the other hench women of Loveless are trying to lock her up in the bedroom. And they're like, get into the device or we'll throw you in the dungeon. And it is fucking stark, man. There are these shackles. It's like a sex swing on top of a bed with a gap where you could roll a wheelchair into. And they're trying to lock her into a thing. Like they are about to do the most egregious bodily harm to this woman. And it's treated like, whoa, that was crazy. I'm glad I got out of there. It's awful.
The stakes involved are so high and it's just not treated with any gravity at all.
No, it really brings you down. Like I watched that scene a second time and just because that was the stretch that I was watching. I was like, man, this is fucking dark. If you think about what they were trying to do to her, it's making me sad and mad right now just thinking about it.
It's fucking gross. That's why this movie engenders no goodwill from me. Like this is neck and neck with That's My Boy for the least favorite movie we've ever had to cover on the podcast.
Yeah.
And a guest didn't even pick this one, so I don't know what the fuck is my excuse because I picked it. I did the spreadsheet.
Did you have any idea going into this? I guess
no, not. I thought it was just going to be like a bad movie, like a generic bad. I thought it was going to be like RIPD or something.
Yeah.
You know, like,
just dumb action comedy.
Just a dumb bad movie. But, King Richard's coming out, which do Will Smith movie. But dude, look at this bullshit now that I'm fucking got to talk about. All right. You want to tell us how this movie ends?
Here we go. So, West and Gordon dodge some flying buzzsaws and escape from Loveless's prison camp. Then they trudge through the desert until they find Loveless's secret fortress hideaway. Loveless comes out in an 80-foot tall mechanical spider and they chase after him, but he successfully kidnaps President Grant and Gordon and brings them back to his lair. As Loveless tries to get Grant to sign over ownership of the United States.
Like a deed to a house? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you gotta sign it over, buddy, or I'll kill you. I don't know. As he's trying to complete the deal, West shows up dressed in drag and attempts to seduce Loveless in front of a crowd of foreign dignitaries, and he almost succeeds. But Loveless once again escapes in his giant spider with the president. Gordon quickly invents a rocket-powered airplane, and he and West fly off to catch Loveless. After a climactic battle on board the giant spider, West finally kills Loveless by dumping him overboard and off of a high cliff. With the threat over, President Grant decides to invent the Secret Service, and he makes West and Gordon its first two agents. And the newly minted partners ride into the sunset together on the giant spider.
The Secret Service did not defend the president until many years after its formation. That was not part of its original.
Oh, okay.
I just want to point that out.
They were about like counterfeiting and stuff?
Yeah, they weren't a presidential detail until much later. So let's talk about the magnet scene.
Yeah.
Where they have these magnetic dog collars on and they're drawn to each other. But did you find that like the strength of the magnets varied wildly from one set piece to the next?
Oh, sure. It was, again, it was cartoon logic. It was like, has anyone ever played with magnets as a kid?
You got to drop in an Insane Clown Posse clip right now of fucking magnets. How do they work?
Fucking magnets. How do they work?
I guess they get pretty big. I haven't been around one of those big electromagnets that they use in car crushing scenarios, but these were little
like Breaking Bad things.
Yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes they could be 5 feet away from each other and be fine. And other times they're being pulled together from 50 feet apart.
Right. Dragged through the dirt with their heels dug in. It was cartoon shit. Like the rules change when you need to do a physical gag. And that's what was going on here. And it's like, man, let them be people or something that we can relate to.
But they got to do a joke where West gets magnetized to Gordon's belt buckle.
Oh, so right.
His head's right near his wiener.
Son of a bitch. I forgot that joke. You had to remind me. Yeah. And he goes, this don't tell your grandchildren about this part of the story. Okay.
Because my head was near a wiener and that's the worst thing that could happen. God forbid. Fuck this movie. And then let's talk about this belly dancing scene where Jim West comes in dressed as a belly dancer and, first of all, allowed to dance up on the prisoners for some reason. Because, you know, you want to give them a show right before you murder them brutally, I guess.
Yeah, this scenario is like these dignitaries of all the powerful nations of Europe are seated here in front of Lovelace and they're negotiating for their pieces of the U.S. once he gets it signed over to him.
Also, I guess this movie has a pretty low opinion of Europe.
Oh, yeah.
They would all take part in this.
They're all the fucking worst.
Yeah, fuck you.
They throw everybody under the bus. England's there. France is there. Spain is there. Mexico's also there. And they're all pieces of shit.
Yeah, they're all on board with this racist monster.
With this monster. But yeah, this is fucking Bugs Bunny, man. You can't walk into a meeting wearing a veil as an exotic belly dancer. That doesn't work in real life. That only works for Bugs Bunny.
I believe when he's wearing the veil, he's Babs Bunny. Is that correct?
Oh, okay, yeah. But Bugs was famous for dressing in drag and seducing Elmer Fudd and seducing whoever the bad guy was. And this is full on Bugs Bunny. Like vintage Bugs Bunny. But I mean, somehow it was better. Oh, was there anyone talented working on Looney Tunes?
Just maybe.
Could have been up to the level of Barry Sonnenfeld. Maybe, but which is sad too, because Sonnenfeld did a bunch of good stuff that we like. Men in Black is great. We loved the...
All that stuff looks worse in retrospect after seeing this movie though. Like I give other people so much more credit for those movies than Sonnenfeld himself after seeing this.
Yeah, we're taking points away.
To be honest, I'm taking points away from his overall score.
Yeah, we found some cracks in his armor, even in Adam's Family, where he made some weird choices.
Yeah.
And he just makes all bad ones in this. But yeah, the way they play the scene, did you think that Lovelace bought it? Was he actually being
seduced? I did, because he's shocked when, for some reason, when West's bra sets on fire, he's like, it's a man. I was like, how do you know that just from his bra setting on fire? Like, you weren't seeing anything. So he seems genuinely surprised at that moment to find out that it's West and not an exotic dancer.
Yeah, so I guess he had gone full Elmer Fudd and was ready to buy into the...
Yeah, I mean, they make him stupid when they need to for the plot. He's not that formidable when the movie needs him to be dumb. But also, West is passing Gordon all these materials to help him escape as he's dancing up on him. And he has the worst sleight of hand I've ever seen. He is taking his sweet-ass time handing him this stuff. It's so obvious to anyone who's watching what's going on. Like, how does nobody pick up on this?
Yeah, is this the kids part of the movie? Like, they did all the over-the-top adult stuff, and then they're like, let's just do a silly kids ending.
That could have been fine if the movie was in that tone, but your brain's not there now because you've seen all this terrible stuff and heard all these terrible jokes. You're like, all right, this is an adult movie for an adult. Oh, wait, now like we're back to fucking Looney Tunes. And it's like pinball with your brain.
It's tough. That's our brains would be. Yeah, no, our brains were beat up by this point in the movie.
Yeah. And then Gordon just invents the airplane willy-nilly. He's got fucking MacGyver, some paper clips, and I think a piece of chewing gum and a rocket, and he makes a little airplane.
Yeah, it works pretty good. I mean, they do the obligatory, whoa, we're going off a cliff, it's not gonna work. And of course, I don't know, are those scenes fun for anybody? Does anybody like, is it gonna work? Are they gonna crash? And Wes is like, what did you call the plane? The something something? Because Gordon has this thing where he creates these things that exist later, like the motorcycle, but he gives it a 10 word stupid descriptive name instead of calling it a motorcycle. He's like, what'd you call this? The blah 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 flying this and that. And he's like, no, I named it after me. I called it Air Gordon because fucking Michael Jordan rules. And we're like,
yeah. He does actually say because fucking Michael Jordan rules. I thought that was a weird choice, but
this was 99. Jordan, he was done at this point, but he had just finished his sixth title. So yeah,
he hadn't come back with the Wizards yet. And that was still to come. But yeah, he was done. He was number 45 already. He was out of the 23 era. So it was already an old joke the time they told it. And now it even more so. Just shit writing. And then Loveless, when we get to his henchmen, because most of his henchmen we've seen throughout the movie are these ladies. He's got like fembots almost fighting on his behalf. But he has these, I believe you called them Hills Have Eyes mutant henchmen. And that's pretty accurate. They've got that kind of look going on of the hill people and the Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah, they all have weird disfigurements or mutations, or they get weirder and weirder as he fights each one.
This was just added in. This was another thing that test audiences didn't like. Our heroes just beating the shit out of a bunch of women in the climax of the movie. So they were like, maybe we should film somewhere he beats up guys. Let's just give him some weird henchmen for the last big fight scene.
It makes more sense. Like, right. Yeah, once you know that, because West gets dumped down to this sub-level of the spider that we had never seen before. And then there's a whole scene down there. And it's like, oh, I get it. They had to tack on a scene. They couldn't undo the stuff that happens on the top decks. They're like, just throw him down a hole and then we'll do a whole another fight scene with mutants in the basement.
And maybe they didn't have that set anymore, so it couldn't be on the main level of the spider. So yeah, they just dropped him down to the spider basement. And that's where this happens.
So it goes from a couple slightly freaky dudes to the big scary one, super tall. The top of his scalp is missing and it's all a steel dome. But Wes keeps throwing shit at the flesh parts, not the steel parts, like his face. And that doesn't hurt him either. He's totally invulnerable. And then he dies. He touches something and gets electrocuted, but I couldn't even see what it was. Could you see what that was?
No, I have no idea what actually killed him. And I didn't care to go back and check. Yeah. But it felt like the movie just wanted to keep it ambiguous, which is what you want for the climax of your movie.
Yeah. So he ends up killing Loveless in this part of the ship too. Loveless comes down to his level and they have a final boss fight and he knocks him out of his chair. But then the chair, I'm just remembering this now as I'm trying to recount it. I forgot that whole thing happened. He gets knocked out of his chair and then his chair turns into some personal spider legs. And so for a minute,
yes,
he's spider powered and he's beating up West. And we have to wonder, is this movie going to end with the hero being killed by the villain? No, funny enough, he shoots out a hydraulic tube or something and the legs go limp and then he ends up pushing him out the door.
But they end up dangling.
Oh yeah, they dangle together long enough to revisit the slur fight.
Yeah, there's some more racist jokes and disabled jokes going on in this part of the movie.
But just a few more crude insults before we kill off the guy in a Hans Gruber style fall to his death.
Let's talk about the spider, because one of the only things I love about the spider is that it exposed me to the John Peters spider story.
Yes, tell us the story.
So Kevin Smith told this story when he was doing a question and answer at some movie theater or college. I can't remember what it was. Clearly, I researched this thoroughly.
It's perfect.
But he said he was hired to write Superman Lives, which was going to be the Tim Burton Superman movie in the 90s. And John Peters was a producer on that movie. And John Peters had three rules for the Superman Lives script.
Okay.
He said, one, I don't want to see him in the suit. Two, I don't want to see him fly. And three, he's got to fight a giant spider in the third act. And Kevin Smith was like, what? Like, why does he need to fight a giant spider? But John Peters would not budge. He said, giant spider fight or I'm not producing this movie. Fuck you. It's got to happen. Write a giant spider fight into the script. Don't care what you have to do. The movie eventually fell apart. Thank God, because Nick Cage was going to play Superman and he was going to have long hair. There's a whole documentary about the Superman Lives movie.
Okay.
How bad it would have been. Check it out. So Smith kind of forgets about it, whatever. And then he said he's in the movie theater watching Wild Wild West. Would you know it? In the third act, there's a big fight with a giant mechanical spider. And who was one of the producers on Wild Wild West, I ask you, Ian?
I couldn't possibly guess that it was John Peters.
It's John Peters. My man has a fetish for giant mechanical spiders and demanded that they be in the movie. So he finally got his big spider and it was in this piece of garbage.
Fitting combination, right? What if he had put that spider in a good movie and ruined a movie that would have been okay except for the giant spider?
Like, yeah, this is it was best. Like, this is where it can do the least amount of collateral damage to the rest of the movie. So it worked out for the best.
And it's replaceable. The bad guy could have had some other type of big war machine.
Or could have just had an airship or something.
Yeah, it could have.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gordon hadn't invented that yet.
That's right.
So that is Wild Wild West, a movie that nobody seems to like. Nobody that worked on this movie likes it. But it ends with a corny rap song. That's how you know it's a Barry Sonnenfeld production.
Bless him. He loves his corny songs. In the credits, Demi Adeyuebe has made a whole career out of mocking the corny Will Smith songs in the credits of Sonnenfeld movies, I guess.
Oh, really?
I mean, one of his main things was like fake Will Smith rap songs over the credits of other movies.
I should check those out. I like his, his Earth, Wind & Fire videos, but yes. I didn't know he had that.
Yeah, he's really good. It's definitely worth watching. We'll see if we can put a link in the show notes to something fun.
Yeah, yeah. We'll drop Demi. Them in there. There's a great podcast guest, too. I like when he's on Doughboys. I always tune in for those. Yeah, nobody liked this movie. Will Smith even asked his mom what she thought of the movie after it was done, and she said, "You've done better, baby." Will Smith eventually apologized publicly to Robert Conrad, star of the original television series. Robert Conrad famously hated this movie as well. He even accepted the Razzies this movie won in person on behalf of the cast and crew of the movie. He was a petty king.
That's awesome.
And Smith confirmed in October 2021 interview that he still considers this his worst movie. And there have been some contenders since this one. He has not put out solid gold since this movie came out.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's not all good, but this one, it stands out.
I have some other quotes from the cast about this movie. So Barry Sonnenfeld, Kevin Kline, Salma Hayek, and of course Will Smith have all stated publicly they dislike it. Hayek said she thought she was being underused. A fair criticism given her role in this movie. And Kline said he considered himself too good of an actor for the finished product. Another fair criticism, I think, though Kevin Kline's not one of my favorite actors or anything, but I still think he's too good for this movie.
Yeah, he's very solid. I've never found him especially likable or a guy that I want to see more of, but like he can act.
He's great in The Birdcage. That's probably like his one role that really sticks out to me. So speaking of Robert Conrad and how much he hated this movie, I don't know how much contemporary audiences at the time cared about the show The Wild Wild West from CBS, but you know, there's always some baggage when you're adapting an existing property and maybe not doing it justice. So do you think the movie might have had a chance to be more successful if they didn't call it Wild Wild West, just gave it its own name?
I absolutely do not think that, but I'm willing to go along with the idea that we should try some other names.
All right, so my faulty premise is just a clear artifice to give us an excuse to talk about a game we haven't played in a while, which is the alternate movie title game. So do you have any ideas for what they could have called this movie?
I think that they should have called this movie Truly Tasteless Jokes, the movie. Yeah, I don't know if you remember those 80s joke books, terrible offensive street jokes compiled into...
No, I'm much younger than you, so I don't remember those.
Yeah, I don't know how long they lasted, but they're like big seller. Like everybody in school had to have these little paperbacks, and it was just all the dead baby jokes, the Helen Keller jokes, every joke at an expense of every disadvantaged type of people, just the worst offensive street jokes collected.
This actually does sound familiar. I feel like somebody brought one of these to school one time.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that would get illicitly passed around at your school for sure. And this movie is like if your Facebook uncle was hired to adapt those books into a movie.
Fair. All right. So I went a little more straightforward. I just said vile, vile mess.
Yeah.
Because I think this movie is a vile mess of a movie and it rhymes with the original title. So there you go. There's not much more to it.
No, straight at it. I went with another sort of insulting title. I thought they should have called it Men in Whack. Because this movie was so whack. By the end, I was hoping that Artemis Gordon would invent a little flashy thing and erase my memory of the whole movie.
Fair. Yeah, that would have been nice. I actually did a play on another Will Smith movie.
Okay.
Because he had recently starred in Enemy of the State when this movie came out. And I hate this movie a lot, so I would consider this movie my enemy. So I said Enemy of the Drake.
Oh, nice. That's a personal one.
It's very personal. I don't know if that would have worked for most audiences. They would have been confused by it. There's no one named Drake in this movie. No references to anyone named Drake, but
it makes sense to me. Yeah. Mine are getting a little stretched thin here. I thought they should have called this movie Nightmare on My Streaming Service, which is a play on a Will Smith song title. If anybody remembers Nightmare on My Streaming, back in 1988, second album by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. He did an unauthorized Nightmare on Elm Street themed rap. And it reminds me that this movie is a nightmare on my streaming service.
I have heard that song. It still pops up on like Spotify Halloween playlists once in a while.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because there's not that many like Halloween novelty songs. So I have heard that song. I just went with Gay Panic as my last one because most of this movie is about gay panic. Also racism, but I thought racism as a movie title just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
So Gay Panic.
Yeah, that would have sold some tickets.
Oh, there's Panic at Needle Park.
Oh, that's true. Gay Panic Room with Jodie Foster.
No, none of these titles would have saved this terrible movie.
No.
Okay, let's talk about how this movie opened. It opened on a Wednesday, as you do for big releases. They get a few more days in the gross. So Wednesday to Sunday, it earned $36.4 million, which isn't great for a movie of this magnitude. Barely beat out Big Daddy, the Adam Sandler comedy.
Yikes.
Which was in its second week.
Oh,
so
man.
That's even bleaker. This is the type of movie you're hoping for $80, $90 million opening week with this kind of budget. And it did not even come close. Other notable new releases were South Park and Summer of Sam. Summer of Sam wasn't a big hit, but South Park, apparently a lot of kids bought tickets to this movie and then snuck in to see South Park. So this movie's ticket prices were inflated even by its own marginal standards by kids buying tickets for this movie and then going to see South Park.
Yeah, I heard people repeating that same legendary story.
And it might be like an anecdote that just got passed around, but it seems likely that at least a few of those tickets were intended for South Park, but spent on Wild Wild West. And I just like the idea that this movie made even less money than it seems to have.
It's also ironic because if the parents knew what was in Wild Wild West, they were thinking, oh, that's a fine movie for my 13-year-old to go to. It wasn't. They should have freaked out about that.
Right. It speaks to the perception I had of this movie that it was for kids. Yeah. And now that I watch it as an adult, I'm like, this movie's horrifying.
There was a whole Burger King kids meal tie-in to this movie marketing, right?
Yeah. And the music video itself was very popular amongst young kids because it's Will Smith famously doesn't swear in his music. It right. was appropriate for all ages. So the next week, American Pie would come out and take the top spot. Wild Wild West would drop down to 16.8 million, more than a 50% drop. And then it would make 10 million in its third week. And then it would fall out of the box office, never to be talked about again until this moment. And interviews with Will Smith, where he's forced to talk about it. So Smith actually went on a bit of a slump after this movie. I was surprised because, like I said, my perception of Smith was that he was a huge star throughout the aughts.
Right.
And had nothing but hit after hit. But I guess his heyday really was the mid to late 90s. Because let's see what his next movies were. So he had The Legend of Bagger Vance. Huge bomb. Critics hated it. Then you've got Bad Boys 2, widely panned, really badly reviewed movie. Surprisingly, it barely doubled its budget. I was very shocked to see that when I was researching for this. I thought Bad Boys 2 was a huge hit.
It has that feeling of a kind of trashy movie that people loved anyway, but I guess they didn't love it that much.
Yeah, and it gets brought up a lot. It seems to have a cultural footprint even to this day for a movie that didn't make a ton of money at the time and that critics hated. But I saw it in theaters and I remember liking it at the time because it's very loud and
yeah,
a lot of explosions and scantily clad women. I think I was 16, 17 when the movie came out, so it was right in my wheelhouse at the time. But yeah, I was surprised to see that was not well received. Men in Black 2 was poorly reviewed. I remember seeing it in theaters. It wasn't good. It cost $50 million more to make than the original and made $150 million less. So it probably still turned a profit, but you got to consider that a disappointment by the metrics of the original.
Yeah.
Bigger budget and you take home a lot less. That's never good. I don't care if it makes money in the long run. That's definitely not what they were hoping for or expecting.
No.
And then iRobot was a hit, but not a huge hit. Got mediocre reviews and had a huge budget.
Yeah, I remember the vibe on that movie was, oh, it's not as good as it should be for a Will Smith sci-fi extravaganza.
That's an Asimov adaptation too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's heady on the sci-fi. It's not Men in Black, at least the source material. And I remember it just being some slam bang action and kind of fun.
It's pretty middle of the road, but it's not terrible. I think Alan Tudyk plays Sonny, the robot in it, which is cool.
Yeah, he's good.
Big fan of his. So Hitch in 2005 would snap him out of his losing streak by being a big hit, and people really liked his performance in that. And it was outside of his wheelhouse at the time because he was doing big action movies and that was more of a romantic comedy.
Did Will Smith do Ali in the middle of this stretch too?
Oh, he did. Yeah.
That to me kept his head above water because that might have not been a big moneymaker, but that was an Oscar bait movie and kept him in that elevated status where you're like, oh, that's Will Smith. He does a lot of cheap action shit, but once in a while he does an Oscar contender.
Yeah, Ali actually did lose money. The reviews for the movie as a whole weren't great, but the reviews for Will Smith in it were really good. So people seemed to really enjoy his performance as Ali, even if they didn't like the movie as a whole. I happen to like that movie. It would be a fun one to do an episode on.
Yeah.
Hard to believe we haven't covered Michael Mann yet. He's had a lot of bombs, sadly. So that was Smith's following movies. Obviously, we know where he's at now. Still a big star, but, you know, his reputation as like a guaranteed moneymaker, I would say, has definitely fallen off.
You're saying, did he earn that back with Hitch? Or are you saying that was like permanently, he's no longer that guy?
I would say permanently, because he's been up and down ever since this movie came out. He's got a hit here and there, but I no longer think you can put him in a movie and it's definitely going to be a hit just because he's in it. I mean, there's very few of those stars left nowadays.
That's true. Most of those stars have a run or they age out of the certain roles and vibe that they can pull off. And people just, they get tired. They want the new flavor.
But he still put out good movies. King Richard's getting great reviews. It seems like he's going to be in Oscar contention for it. So
yeah, now he's in sort of elder statesman territory, especially playing a father figure like that. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Absolutely. The reviews are coming out and they're looking good now. Klein and Branagh actually reunited the next year in the animated Bond, The Road to El Dorado. They were both in that together. So that's fun. That'll be a fun one to talk about someday. They've both had pretty steady careers. Klein's been making movies at a good pace, but typically smaller movies, dramas, or more low-key comedies or whatever. But Branagh's probably more prolific or well-known as a director now. He still acts for sure, but he's really getting his directing on. He's got a big movie coming out soon. Belfast is also getting Oscar buzz.
That's right. He could be in the Best Picture running this year.
Yeah, Best Picture, Best Director. It's apparently autobiographical too. So show.
Yeah. Is he looking back? Is he still regretting Wild Wild West at this point? Or does he feel like maybe he's done okay for himself?
You see, he's one of the guys, I think, he looked back on it and knew it was shit. But he was like, I cashed the check and whatever. I had fun making it. He didn't seem to get too hung up on it. But also, he's not the star. Like, Will Smith had to wear this around his neck like an albatross for a few years. Where I don't think anyone's like, Kenneth Branagh. Oh, the guy from Wild Wild West. He's in it, but he's not the guy.
Yeah, he's a big presence on the screen. But in another year, I'll have forgotten that he's in this movie.
Do you know what Will Smith turned down to be in this movie?
As a matter of fact, I do. This is one of the legendary casting decisions in Hollywood lore.
He turned down the role of Neo in The Matrix to play Jim West in Wild Wild West.
One of those incredible what would have been. I mean,
he turned down Django as well, which is obviously a few years later, but his misses are pretty big.
Yeah.
Will Smith maybe needs to reevaluate how he picks his movies.
Yeah, he tells the story in this vlog. Have you seen the thing where Will Smith is talking to the camera about how the Wachowskis pitched him The Matrix? And they were just telling him about the bullet time effect. And what if you could jump in the air and freeze and the camera could spin all around you? And he was like, okay, I'll pass.
I'm going to go fight a giant spider in the desert.
Looking in the rearview mirror would have been a much better decision to take Neo. But I don't know, The Matrix would have been a really different movie. And I'm happy with The Matrix that we got. And Will Smith did fine. So like,
and I guess if you try to explain The Matrix to somebody who's not familiar with it, it sounds fucking crazy. Like, it's not a sure thing as far as like a hit movie goes. It's not based on pre-existing IP. It's an original idea that doesn't really have a quick elevator pitch that makes sense.
From some weird visionary creators, like that have to try to explain it to you versus, should I just hook up with my guy Barry that we made 10 gajillion bucks on Men in Black and just try to make another hit in the Hollywood pipeline? Like, it's a sensible decision.
So did you have a beautifully put together final thought that you wanted to give us to summarize your feelings about Wild Wild West?
No, but I'm going to say something that I wrote down anyway. I spent time thinking over this movie and writing out all my notes, and I started to get heated as we did during this very episode. And then something I like to do is I went back and searched the Roger Ebert review of the movie, and it's just a gem. He calls out all of the flaws in the movie. He skewers it perfectly, but also the writing is artful and his tone. I just love the way he wrote those reviews, and this was just a perfect one. It gave me a real genuine laugh, and then I felt better about the movie. I'm like, okay, I don't have to take it upon myself to enact my wrath upon this movie. Roger Ebert did it better than I ever could. I had a laugh. I released a lot of tension, and I was thankful for Roger Ebert. May the Lord of movies rest his soul.
I have his books. He has two books that are just compilations of his most scathing reviews.
Oh, awesome.
One's called Your Movie Sucks. And the other's called I Hated This Movie. And as great as his writing is when he loved a movie, there's just something about his negative reviews that are like comfort food for me. Even if I've never seen the movie, I'll just reread those reviews over and over again. Yeah, get them, Raj. But no, instead of writing a final thought, I decided to give you a list of things I'd rather watch than Wild Wild West.
Oh, cool. What would you rather see?
R.I.P.D.
Okay.
Dreamcatcher.
Sure, I can go with that.
Lady in the Water.
Wow, okay.
Footage from my colonoscopy.
What's getting serious?
And the scene where Bambi's mother gets shot, but just repeated over and over again ad nauseum.
That's somehow less heavy and less of a downer
than this movie. This children's adventure movie that was apparently supposed to be just a summertime blockbuster full of fun.
Just fun. Just James Bond in the old West, shooting up the bad guys, using some gadgets, meeting some pretty ladies.
This one took it out of me, man. But we'll be back next week with a slightly better movie. We're going to be talking about Julie Taymor's Across the Universe, the Beatles musical drama romantic.
Let's not overpromise, but it will be fun to talk about that movie too, as it always is.
Oh, I'll watch Across the Universe 5 fucking times before I watch this movie again. But yeah, so check that out. Just in time for Get Back, which is Peter Jackson's new big old documentary series about the Beatles.
We love to try to be topical.
Trying to be topical.
Topics that are in the zeitgeist, as they say.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. Please remember to follow us on Twitter at BlastZonePod. Rate, review, subscribe to the podcast, whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. Shoot us an email if you have a suggestion for a movie you want us to cover or a question we can answer for you. We're BlastZonePod@gmail.com. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone. The Blast Zone.